Thank you very much for inviting me here today. This is actually my first SIGINT. I've been coming to CCC events for a while, but this is my first one, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk today. So about a year and a half ago, I was in Brussels for a workshop that Google and Privacy International hosted. The goal of this workshop was to develop policy language around privacy that Google could use in negotiating with governments. I'm guessing trade agreements and things like that. No one was especially able or willing to give me specific details. But, you know, about user privacy, what sort of protections have to be applied to data on the wire and data at rest and so on, and what governments can and can't do with respect to the data that private or publicly traded companies collect and use in the course of their business. Now, this workshop was held under Chatham House rules, one of which says that I can quote things that people said, but I can't attribute them directly. On the first day of the conference, they offered two tracks. There was a technical track and a policy track. There were a bunch of really sharp technical people there, academics and industry people and independent researchers and like half the Tor project. And while I didn't know most of the policy people, there were a whole lot of folks from the EFF and other good guy kinds of organizations, and I have to figure out if they managed to pick up a qualified slate of technical experts, they probably did a decent job on the policy side too. But you could go to whichever track you wanted. It wasn't, you know, segregated by specialty or anything like that. So we all meet up. It's about 9 o'clock in the morning. There's coffee and about half an hour to meet and greet. And then they sit us all down and they give us an overview of the next 2 days and they tell us we can go to whichever room we want, technical or policy. And I notice that every hacker I recognize, along with the computer science academics and so on, they're all headed into the tech room. And I'm like, huh. Because, I mean, sure, I know a thing or two about Tor, but they've already got half the Tor project. Not to mention the academics there knew everything I know about privacy and then some. And there were even enough people who knew enough about LangSec that even if it came up, they didn't really need me. And apart from that, I'm not really sure what I have to offer. So I decide, okay, since the point of this whole affair is to produce policy language anyway, I'll go see if I can contribute to that. You know, make sure there's an engineering perspective represented and that kind of thing. Now remember, Chatham House rules, so I can't directly attribute quotes. What I can tell you is that maybe 45 minutes, an hour into the discussion, some fuck up who'd been sitting there fidgeting at the way that things had been going pipes up and says, can we take as axiomatic that it's a bad idea to just up and break the internet? And the whole room turns and says, no. I mean, it wasn't quite as direct as that. There was some spirited discussion, but it very quickly became clear that to everyone in the room that was willing to open their mouth, apart from this one fuck up, the very idea of a global interconnected network was something like a lump of modeling clay that you could squish and mold, shape and reshape by fiat. Never mind that there was only a thin wall between them and a whole room minus one full of engineers talking about the incredibly intricate details and constantly moving parts of this really quite fragile, when you think about it, putative lump of modeling clay. So a little later, this same fuck-up was having lunch, and got into a conversation with one of the other people from the policy room, during which the other person advanced the claim, and I'm pretty sure that they were not being ironic, that mathematics had to be subordinated to national sovereignty. That was the point where I said to myself, shit, y'all, we got a problem. Because as far as I can tell, every single person at that workshop was supposed to be one of the good guys. But when the good guys can't even agree on what reality is, how far can they really get toward agreeing what good is? So now it's 2013, and the front page of pretty much every major metropolitan newspaper has been carrying articles for weeks on PRISM, on Edward Snowden, on the NSA's actions in Germany, and in the rest of the EU. And it's tempting to think that the lines are really clear. You know, the NSA violated everyone's rights, not to mention EU data protection laws. Therefore, NSA bad, therefore everyone else good, which includes Edward Snowden. Therefore, what the hell are all these other countries doing, hiding behind excuses like, he has to apply for asylum from within our country. You know, and then Venezuela comes into the picture, and there's some arguing about trade agreements, and all of Europe's foreign ministers are suddenly very preoccupied, and there's bad news out of the European Central Bank again, and we all come off looking like sellouts. And everyone around the world feels vaguely unsatisfied. Crucially, nothing has actually happened. Perspectives may have changed. Opinions may have changed. But Edward Snowden is still somewhere in the transit zone at Moscow Airport, and PRISM is, as far as we know, still in operation. Enormous amounts of cogitation have been expended over this topic. Gallons of ink have been spilled. Millions of man-hours of human computation, and at least an equivalent amount of CPU computation, have been devoted to it. People obsess over the ins and outs of the rights and wrongs of what Snowden did, or of the legality or the illegality of the NSA's actions, and meanwhile, the ingestion systems just merrily continue ingesting. Because nearly everything that matters is a side effect. I should explain at this point what exactly it is I mean by side effect, but I'm going to have to start with a counterexample. In pharmacy, for instance, there's this notion of the clinical effect and the side effect, where the clinical effect is the effect you want to produce, like reducing pain or cooling off a fever, and the side effect is something that you don't want to produce, like a metabolic product that's incredibly toxic to your liver. And this is the usage that's made its way into everyday language, and it carries with it this notion that there are always trade-offs. You can take just enough paracetamol to take away your headache without also killing your liver. And this is reliable enough across the entire human population that we feel comfortable selling it over the counter and giving it to children. And we end up thinking about side effects as something that we manage. In the case of paracetamol, adding up to a few hundred thousand emergency room visits a year due to accidental overdose, but I'll get back to that. In computer science, what we mean by side effect is anything that changes the state of the system. If the intended result of your computation produces some change in state, then it's actually a side effect. If an unintended result of your computation produces some change in state, it's also a side effect. Intent means nothing whatsoever. This is where exploits come from. You could have given that person a third dose of paracetamol after they threw up the first two because you were trying to help them with their fever and didn't realize how quickly the stomach absorbs paracetamol. This actually happened to someone I know. Or you could have been straight up trying to murder them. You know, computer science only acknowledges the side effect of the person landing in the emergency room with a failing liver. By the way, she did survive. So this is why, the other day, when a Belgian business news reporter interviewed me about PRISM and finished off by asking for my number one piece of security advice for Belgian companies, I told him, focus on your responsibility to your customers and follow the OWASP best practices. And I had to explain OWASP to him, which was a little disappointing, but you know, he got the point, which I thought was pretty encouraging. I mean, if you're a European company and a copy of your trade secret algorithm is sitting on an NSA hard drive right now because somebody's Git traffic transited through the States, it's still gonna be sitting there tomorrow, and there's not a hell of a lot you can do about that. But you can take steps to harden the machines that that algorithm is executing on right now, and those steps are persistent side effects. They have lasting impact. They matter. And there's an extent to which I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here, because we get that. It's almost like a sense you develop when you observe a system over a long period of time, whether we're talking about a telephone trunk system or the time-sharing systems at MIT or the early ARPANET. All of that is way before my time, but that's fine, because it's not a sense that you have to be in some particular time or place to acquire. I mean, I got mine on IRC. It's network proprioception. Boxes come up, boxes go down, the shape of the network changes, and as you interact with that network and start learning what all of its little flags and options do, how change propagates, you develop an awareness of the state of the system that I think it's really only fair to compare to your awareness of the state of yourself. Certainly from a philosophical standpoint, they're about equally hard to talk about. But I think it's fair to say that hackers who know what they're doing, reasonably competent hackers, let's say, you know, correlate inputs to a system with outputs from that system, and when they can, internal state changes in that system, in much the same way that people who are reasonably self-aware can think abstractly about what they experience, consider their internal responses, and produce some outward response, or not, as the case may be. And for that matter, to learn from their mistakes. I think that in much the same way as Douglas Adams characterized the knack of flying as learning to throw yourself at the ground and miss, it's entirely fair to characterize the knack of hacking as learning how you yourself can fail more quickly until whatever you're analyzing fails in exactly the way you want it to. But having this kind of mindset at all, which is really just the scientific method all over again, nature being obeyed in order to be commanded and all that, turns out to be rarer than you'd expect, at least if you're me, which to be fair means that most of the people you spend any time with at all are scientists or hackers or both. And this is not all that large of a sector of the population to begin with. And we're in a funny situation here, where for the last couple of years, there's been an unusually large proportion of international attention paid to the hacker community and hacker culture by people who don't have the faintest fucking idea how we think. There's a saying for this in the United States, armchair quarterbacking. The metaphor refers to the guy who's sitting there in his armchair at home, drinking beer and shouting at his big screen TV what he thinks the quarterback ought to be doing in the football game. I mean, maybe he's played some football, maybe he even coaches kids on weekends or something, but there's this tacit understanding that for all of his rhetoric, even when he's right, he's still just there in his armchair. If he really understood how to coach a team to glory, he'd be out there in the game putting that understanding into practice. And this gets murky in the world of policy, where you can have economists like Felix Salmon who wax rhetorical about Bitcoin without having the first fucking idea what a hash function is, much less how one functions as a component of a billion-dollar financial system. I mean, he literally does not understand what he is talking about, but he understands enough about money, or at least what money means in the parlance of the modern international finance system, that he thinks he understands what he's talking about, and worse, that people should listen to him, even though what he's actually talking about and what he thinks he's talking about are systems as wildly disparate as two very disparate things. If Bitcoin is going to make any sense to you, you have to accept the notion that the levers and dials that financial regulators are used to being able to fiddle with just aren't there. The currency itself is inherently resistant to regulation because Satoshi Nakamoto built that system like a deist god. The parameters of the system, from block difficulty to reward having time, were built into that system from the moment the Genesis block got written out to disk. And every time I hear one of these armchair cryptocurrency specialists, you know, who may be top-notch economists, but who crucially spend so much of their time thinking about how to manage systems where unit of account and unit of exchange mean the same thing, that the very idea of decoupling those concepts is crazy moon language, talking about how inherently doomed Bitcoin is, I kind of want to come back with, so how many billion-dollar financial systems have you built in the last couple years? I mean, think about that for a second. We live in a world where if somebody comes up with a useful enough idea and reduces it to practice in code that other people can actually use, and enough other people decide it's also a useful idea, a couple of years down the line, it turns into $1 billion in monetary capacity. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to pretend that that's $1 billion worth of state change. It's not $1 billion worth of side effects. A lot of the volume that goes into making that number that large is people chasing bubbles. And it's reasonable to expect the usual sort of outcomes that you get from chasing bubbles, namely other floating currencies disappearing into thin air when people decide it's time to get out. But I've also lost count of how many times I've heard the usual pundits predict that surely this Bitcoin price spike is going to be the one that kills the golden goose. And every time, like clockwork, the damn thing crashes, dusts itself off, and keeps going. It's almost as if being able to move units of exchange around internationally without having to pay rent to the established financial system is something people find value in. Go fucking figure. So it should surprise approximately no one that the next line of defense is, of course, regulation. What surprises me is that it's taken as long as it has. Satoshi did an amazing, unprecedented thing. He designed a protocol that inherently resists tampering. In fact, it's so inherently tamper-resistant that you can't actually regulate Bitcoin. You have to either take over the entire network, or you have to take a step back and regulate the exchanges where people turn other currency into Bitcoin and vice versa, which, in fact, is exactly what's happening. I mean, yes, at the moment, you know, all that FinCEN is saying is, we want you to register as a money trader. But I'm actually going to divert from my script a little bit and tell a little story that Len told me once. So lockpicking used to be a hobby in England, and there was, you know, there was the obligatory hue and cry from, you know, the police saying, "Oh my God, if people are learning how to pick locks, then that's going to increase crime." And so the lockpickers of the UK decided to create a voluntary licensing scheme. And as soon as they were finished with that, the government was like, nice idea, it's ours now. And now you can't be you can't pick locks in the UK without being subject to this licensing scheme that the lock-picking community voluntarily subjected themselves to and then has had used against them ever since then. And I get where the Winklevoss twins are going when they say that regulation means that Bitcoin is maturing as a financial instrument, but I don't for a moment think that that's necessarily good for users. If Bitcoin maturing means that the majority of its users have to rent their liquidity from a regulator-approved set of oligarchs, then Bitcoin's advantages against other currencies are going to evaporate. And if that happens, then the status of the financial system remains a lot closer to quo than it otherwise would. And I can't think of many things that an established rentier likes more than the status quo, because nearly everything that matters is a side effect. Now, I'm hardly going to fault Satoshi for not solving the liquidity problem, in addition to not only solving the double spending problem in a distributed setting, but also doing it in a way that people actually ended up using. I mean, one side effect at a time is fine, especially when you expect it's going to be a big one and you want to find out whether it even works the way you anticipate it will. But this leads me to the next category of people who are suddenly especially interested in what hackers do without giving much thought to why, and that's people who desperately want to stave off any kind of side effects at all. Let me give you a recent example. Maybe a week or two ago on Hacker News, I came across an impassioned article about the difference between science and technology. The author's primary claim was that although the process of scientific discovery and the process of technological creation, say, performing an experiment to test a hypothesis versus designing and implementing a protocol, although these are both performed by humans who have politics, therefore these processes have political effects because of the humans' politics, the outcome of the scientific process is apolitical because nature remains the same no matter what your view of the world is. And I'd even agree with that. But then he advances this claim, and I quote, TCPIP et al. Are technologies created by people, smart, well-paid white guys typically, with politics as much as they deny it because they're scientists. You can probably say they've made a blip in our politics. They are inherently political. We need to work out what their politics is, what they encourage or discourage before we use them to solve political problems. Okay, Mr. Smart, well-paid white guy. I mean, seriously, do not give me that fucking look. You live in the Western Hemisphere, you have a blog, you are paid better than most of the fucking planet. We'll just tell damn near everyone in the Middle East, not to mention every single Kenyan who's been coming up with uses for GSM that the makers probably never even imagined, much less intended, since long before there was an Arab Spring to vex your stony political sleep, that they need to put down their mobiles and back away from Twitter because the flying spaghetti monster only knows what those beastly protocols might encourage or discourage. I mean, Hosni Mubarak had a few ideas about that, which is why he decided to shut them down entirely, and we all saw how well that worked out for him. I'm used to reactionaries. I grew up in Texas. I'm just not used to reactionaries coming in from the left. And I guess in a way, it's a sign that the left is maturing in much the same way that Bitcoin is maturing, which is to say, becoming part of an established system that finds side effects inherently existentially threatening. And if you can con somebody into holding still for fear of what waves they might make if they were to move, whether it's through guilt or fear or what have you, you no longer have to worry about their side effects. It's the liberal version of fuck you got mine. Now, I got my first taste of this right around 25C3, when there was some press coverage of the biohacking work that I'd been doing with Lactobacillus. If you ever want to see a Democrat supporting gun rights, telling him one of his neighbors is doing synthetic biology in their kitchen seems to work pretty well. I have never gotten more death threats than I did when the Huffington Post picked up that article. And we can talk until we're blue in the face about why that is. But I think what's most interesting is that when presented with a sufficiently large example, people will blithely throw away what up until then they'd considered some of their most cherished beliefs, like guns being evil or murder being wrong, at least for the sake of argument. I mean, obviously nobody's come up and shot me yet, so apparently nobody's completely pitched those beliefs out the window, and I'll take that as a good thing. I mean, I am generally in favor of not being shot. But I'm also in favor of change that I can see, not merely change that I can believe in. And if that means poking the status quo with a stick to see what it does, I'm more inclined to do that than not. And if it responds, I'm just as inclined to do it again, like that XKCD comic with the electric shock button. Maybe I find a little more about how it works. Maybe I found out a way it breaks. Either way, I've learned more about it than I knew before. And crucially, I never would have found out if I hadn't picked up that stick. You can think of the human brain in a lot of ways, but probably the most useful way I know of to think about it is as a massively parallel pattern matching machine. Your neocortex learns to recognize patterns, and it builds an ontology out of those patterns so that from light and shadow, you can discern edges, and from edges, you can discern shapes, and from shapes, you can discern whether something you're looking at is something you've already identified or something novel, no matter what direction you're looking at it from, which is kind of the most amazing part to me. We quite literally spend the first couple of weeks of our lives learning how to see and hear. The machinery is all there. We've already been using it in utero, but now we have to adapt to this weird outside the uterus environment, and that means learning how to use those senses all over again. But the secret is, you never stop learning. The human brain is amazingly plastic well on into adulthood, as long as you're willing to continue exposing it to novel experiences that it has to learn to pattern match, preferably lots of them, so that you don't overtrain to an input set that's too small. You know? And we're only just starting to learn in the last 20, 30 years how this works for machine learning. We're barely scraping the surface of how this works for the human brain, but what we do know about the brain is way the hell better at it than any algorithm we've developed so far. Now, I can't tell you what a social sense feels like, at least not the way that I can describe network proprioception. I was actually born without a social sense, and I'm still working on putting one together from the parts that I have available. But I want to know what we could build if we had people who developed proprioception for, if you will, the body politic. We may very well already be creating those people, given that Western children now grow up in a society where social graphs as graphs are a major input on a daily basis. I look forward to seeing them grow up, but if those kids aren't kicking the tires, which is what kids are supposed to do in the first place, and I guess in a big way what, you know, we never really grew out of, where are they going to find the side effects that will tell them how these network effects behave? So, before I conclude, I know somebody's going to ask during the Q&A, so what is it that matters that's not a side effect? Getting it right in the first place. I mean, if your goals are evil goals, if your intentions are evil intentions, you know, if the point of what you're going, if the point of your action is to, you know, silence people or kill them or take their take their land rights away, the good side effects that you produce are not going to, they're not going to overwhelm the bad side effects that are, in the pharmaceutical sense, the clinical, the clinical goal of your action. Yeah. But that seems a little bit obvious. I just figured somebody was going to ask. And with that, I guess I'm open for questions. Oh, come on, somebody has to disagree with me about something. Yes. You want me to repeat the question? Oh, right, sorry, my bad. Okay, it's death before dishonor, nothing before coffee. All right, so the question was, Actually, why don't you just go ahead and repeat it, because... Okay, so the question was basically, you know, tell me if I'm rephrasing this accurately since you have a microphone now, but shouldn't we expect that if somebody approaches a system with evil intent and produces bad side effects, won't those side effects be sufficient to cause the people to revolt? And I think we'd all like to think that, but you know, how well is that actually working out in the United States? I mean, if you'll permit me to kind of spin off into political theory for a minute. So there's a political scientist named Duverger who spent his career studying elections. And he developed a principle called Duverger's Law, which basically says that the failure case of a two-party system the failure case of a first past the post voting system, like any voting system where whoever gets the most votes wins, even if they didn't get more than half, that's necessarily going to devolve into a two party system like we have in the United States, and that any other kind of voting system like ranked choice or anything equivalent to that. You end up with a parliamentary system, and so your failure case is something like Belgium, where if nobody can agree on anything, then you just don't have a government for a while. Now, the U.S. has been a two-party system for well over a century. Canada and the U.K. have kind of managed to avoid that fate. Like, they've still kind of got third parties that, you know, that people try to believe in. At least more so than the Libertarian Party or the Green Party in the United States. But what I find myself observing, just watching United States politics, is that there's not really two parties anymore. There's one. There's one party that presents two faces, and it gives people enough to argue about. You know, some of which is actually seriously fucking relevant. I mean, you know, when you're talking about, like, you know, your right not to get fired from your job because you're transgender, you know, that's a pretty reasonable thing for people to actually fight for. But there's a lot of other topics that just get dredged to the surface every time it looks like there's going to be some, you know, some plausible competitor in the system, you know, and I think that kind of gets back to what I was saying about rent seeking earlier. You know, the political machine in the United States is an amazing rent seeking opportunity if you're already in it or can get yourself into it. But if you try to challenge that as a third party, you're either going to get subsumed or you're going to get crushed, because that's how the rentiers like to play the game. So what I find fascinating about this, appalling at the same time, mind you, but just fascinating because it's just because like these are algorithms that are just evolving as we're watching them, and it's kind of amazing. You know, Marx talked about religion being the opiate of the masses. Holy damn, America is amazing at building new drugs. So, you know, I don't have a good answer to that, but I think that I think probably the biggest part of the problem is that people have gotten used to the status quo just never changing.
I think your answer was good.
I can stop now. But yeah, any other questions? Because I could probably keep talking about that for a while.
I'd just like to propose that the biggest case of evil intentions with good side effects is called military. It is provably the worst intention, like maximize killing, but then out came things like the internet and porn and kitten pictures.
Can't argue with the rich, y'all.
I have not heard your talk, but regarding side effects, what if the players do not recognize irony? Like, for example, military, they act because of the budget, like they're in post-scarcity world, but they are not in a post-scarcity world, so
I missed the noun there. They're not what?
Post-scarcity
world. Oh, yes, okay.
So military acts like if it's in a post-scarcity world, like oil that is $200 per gallon or something, but they aren't actually in such a world, so can it be that good side effects aren't actually applicable until the people change their mind about what world they're living in?
Well, I think you raise a very good point there, that you know, when one player in the game can just up and change the rules and say, I'm interested in your assertion that the weird pricing structure of the military is evidence that they're playing by post-scarcity rules. I'd like to explore that like in depth, and I think we're not going to have time right now, but like later this weekend, I'm very curious about that. But were you here for the distinction that I drew between side effects in the sense that we know that...
I think the point is that maybe the side effects don't apply if the players don't recognize that they are...
Oh, they don't recognize them, but they're absolutely still there. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of dead people whenever the U.S. Army leaves a village in Afghanistan.
Oh, okay.
Anybody else? All right, well, thank you very much.